Welcome to Night Shift Delirium, a podcast about junior doctors and the world that surrounds them. I'm your host, Victoria, a junior doctor based in England. And I know it's been a while, y'all. Please forgive me. As you all know, I am a full-time doctor and part-time podcaster. As such, sometimes life just gets in the way. I'm really excited to share with you all today's episode, which is also the season finale. I interviewed Charlene, who is a doctor based in the United States. She's an illustrator, a med influencer, and now an author. We spoke about her book On Rotation, which is available wherever you order books from, locally and bigger corporations like Amazon and Audible and all of those good things. We spoke about the book and some of the characters and the plot. And we also spoke a little bit about her own story and her own journey into medicine. I absolutely loved the interview, and I absolutely loved the book. So I hope you all enjoy today's episode. Welcome to our shift, y'all. Hello, hello. Welcome to Night Shift Delirium. I am so excited to be speaking with the author of On Rotation, Charlene. How do you pronounce your last name? I don't want to say
it's pronounced Obobi. Bow like a bow tie.
Okay. Okay. I'm Ghanaian as well. So I just never, you never know. You don't want to say the wrong thing.
But I didn't realize you were also Ghanaian.
I am, which is why I think I loved the book so much. Because anyway, we'll get into that. But you are an author, an illustrator, a cardiologist. Is there anything else you would include in this introduction of yourself?
I think that's pretty good. I think you covered the career basis.
Amazing. Oh my goodness. I am just so impressed and shocked and confused, because how do you do all of it? I've got this little podcast that I do on the side. I'm coming off of a night shift that was absolute carnage last night, and I am on the struggle bus, and I likely will be for the rest of the week. And you're a proper, and like, importantly, my mic is like propped on how to read ECGs, because despite being a doctor for 3 years now, it's giving zigzag, you know? How do you manage all of this? How did you get into it to begin with?
So I've been drawing and writing since I was a kid. Like, as in, the first book I wrote was when I was 6 years old. It was about Lucky the Dog. I illustrated it as well. I wrote something again when I was 10. I self-published a book when I was 14. So writing is something that is very much a part of me. Storytelling is a part of me. And what I always tell people when they ask me this question is that I too am on the struggle bus. I'm always on the struggle bus. But I use storytelling to cope and also to process. And because it is intrinsic to who I am and so necessary for that process for me, I make time, right? It just happens. And I write in between patients, and it helps fill my pot again, so it doesn't feel so much like work.
I love that. And I remember when just quick background, I'm Ghanaian American, came to England, and I've been sort of all around. But in undergrad, I did this program, and one of the other students who was there was also Ghanaian. And he's like, you know, when you're on rotations and you've got that person who's got this big personality and they're clearly trying to make a presence for themselves. And he's like, I'm Ghanaian, and by nature, we are storytellers. So my only question to you is, what's the craziest thing that's ever happened? And it's like kind of a really basic question, but his lead up to it was everything. It engaged everyone, and his basis for that, I was like, all right, storytelling is very much so a part of Ghanaian culture. Like, we've got Anansi, we've got proverbs, we have so many things that we don't even think about, but actually that's how we learn. It's how we've learned how to sort of cope with the world. So I think that's really interesting.
I love that. And I completely agree. Like, even down to like our cross symbols, our proverbs, our language, it's full of narratives.
Everything is story. I mean, even if you're talking about someone's relation to you, it's not like my aunt. No, it's my mother's sister's, like whatever, whatever. And that's just how we speak naturally in some ways. So it's nice to see it sort of crafted into a formalized skill. So that's great. That's amazing. Did you ever at any point think, you know what, I think I'm just going to do writing. I don't want to do medicine. Where did that intersection happen? How did that conversation internally and externally go?
So I've actually never really considered just doing my art or my writing. And it's a question I get pretty frequently. And I think it's because of my answer to your first question, which is that for me, creating provides an escape and a way to process. And that if I had to do it to eat, it would take away a lot of the joy for me. I also think in a lot of ways, my medicine does, and like the medicine informs my craft, right? I'm probably always going to write fiction, but probably in the healthcare space, probably always about Ghanaian American women who are doctors or other types of healthcare workers, right? And probably, I'm probably always going to use it to reflect on some experience that I have or some having or some thoughts that I'm having, you know? So I think that they're going to go hand in hand. The second part of that, which is whether how much of the medicine I'm going to do in the future, is still up in the air though.
And I felt that. Okay. I feel that deep in my soul. And, you know, I am also like a very creative person. I created some brand when I was in med school, not unsurprisingly, at a time where I was supposed to be studying for STEP, I decided to pick on a professional hobby.
Of course.
But I equally feel that, you know, creation and creativity actually go so hand in hand with medicine. And I think sometimes you could be so focused on like the hard sciences and like this pathway and this treatment, but we are all sort of creating a narrative in our own with every patient that we meet. You know, you're creating a narrative, you're coming up with a plan, you're thinking about their future. And how it all goes together within one story. There's a reason why when you're presenting sometimes, someone's like, what's the story? You know, what's right. Going on there? So there's definitely a connection there. I do want to talk more about you, but I just need to get into the book a little bit.
Because of course.
I loved it. I really did. I thought, I was like, oh, well, we'll see how this goes. You never know. Then I'm like, first of all, at the start, when she's talking about the body-yadi, as a Ghanaian myself, with the assets myself, I was like, listen, is this me? I don't know, but I see me in this and I love it. I mean, yeah, it's so rare, you know, as a reader, as what all of the different identities that we all have to see yourself reflected in a book. And Angie, in so many ways, was me. I'm Ghanaian. I did my medical rotations in Chicago. The struggle of your parents that are like, we're Ghanaian. And then they get to Ghana and they're like, ayo, Bruni, like, what? Are you sure? Because the accent is not giving Kumasi right. Or Accra. And then you come back and they're like, okay, Ghanaians do this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so how did you decide on the concept and third year in particular? What spoke to you there?
Yeah, so first of all, I'll say that I'm always so touched when Black women and especially Ghanaian American women and especially like say that they see themselves in the novel, because that was, I say it in my dedication, right? Like I wrote this book for us, right? Everybody else, of course, I want them to love it too, right? But it's really for us. So,
and we love it, and we thank you.
thank you. I will start with, why did I even start deciding to write this concept? You know, up until my second year of medical school, which is when I wrote the very first chapter, I was scared of writing about people who were like me, right? I had received feedback during the very few classes I took from my classmates that every single time I wrote about a Black woman, every single time I wrote with a Ghanaian American protagonist, I would get this feedback that, oh, was this you? Is this autobiographical? And it's something I still get quite often when I'm talking about on rotation. And it was only when I went to a talk by Juno Diaz, where he specifically spoke to this. He specifically spoke to the writers of color. He was like, look, you need to write your own story, right? Like, and don't be afraid of it. People are going to tell you all this stuff. Write your own story because you're the only one who can tell it. And I took that to heart, and it really inspired me to be like, hey, you know what? Like, my experience is a Ghanaian American physician, right? Like, why not? Why can't I also tell that, right? And that, you know, when you pick up most novels that are written from other perspectives, the authors are also very similar. They often write about, if it's a, like, lawyers and writers and publicists and other things that a lot of people who write happen to do, right? And so that's what kind of inspired me to write it in the first place. I did take a long break. I wrote like the first chapter in my second year of med school, and then I basically didn't touch it until residency. And in residency, I had done a lot of growing. And I had more time to kind of reflect on my early 20s. It's a very tumultuous time. There are a lot of things that are changing. And I think third year especially is when things like professionally change dramatically, right? You go from being a student in the sense of sitting in classrooms, listening to lectures, to being out with patients and having to really modulate your personality for each rotation that you're on, right? You're having to consider the opinions of so many people you don't know who have so much control over your career, right? You're having to decide for yourself what you want to be when you grow up, right? Like you finally, you're making it to the doctor thing. Now you have to decide what kind of doctor you want to be. And it's incredibly stressful and time intensive as well. You have to study on top of being in the hospital 8 to 9 hours a day, you know, sometimes more than that, 12 hours a day, you know. And I really wanted to use that because it's a coming of age in the sense of a career, to talk about the coming of age in other aspects of Angie's life.
Yes, absolutely. I think, yeah, so I'm like a very non-traditional student. I had a very long journey into medicine, blah, blah, blah. And I remember when I finally made it to third year, which felt so impossible. I mean, just one being even in a position where I can say like I'm a student doctor was just wild. Like I graduated undergrad in 2010, started med school in 2015. And didn't throw away my organic chemistry books until third year, because I was like, I guess now I can say maybe I might have been. Again, it was a struggle. But when I got to third year, I remember having this sinking feeling in morning. I guess I don't even know what it was called, whatever the morning meeting was before we went to like our individual teams. And I was like, oh my God, it's not just two more years. This is like going on for a very long time. Is this what I'm ready for? Like, it was so overwhelming. It was a very transformative year for me as well, because I think you said so much, like you're packaging yourself. Like you're essentially now starting your interview process without you even knowing it for residencies. And whatever preconceived notions that any attending or residents or your other fellow students have isn't misconstrued in a really negative way, in a way that very few people can relate to. It's such a unique identity, and every day of third year, you have to sell yourself in that way. And it's exhausting, and people don't talk about it. You know, they're just like, oh yeah, medical school, they're smart, whatever, that's tiring. But the emotional labor that's required of everyone, but especially any like minority or marginalized community, is so much greater, you know? Absolutely. And I think what this book really captures so well is this performative thriving that we all try and have in medical school. When we're really just trying to survive, you are super insular, you are super focused. And then also, this is a formative time in your life. For the most part, most people are younger. They're trying to explore friendships and romantic things and trying to thrive, you know, on their rotations and hit these targets that we have numerically. You know, what was your step score? And you've got all these people that are so braggadocious. And, you know, that moment where she's like, she didn't even feel like talking to people. I was like, listen, that is me. Don't talk to me. It's done. And that's it. Don't ask me any more questions. But so we've got, you know, we validate ourselves numerically. We validate ourselves through our sacrifice. Like, it's a flex to say that you've come in really early and left really late and you're not sleeping right. very much. Why is that a flex? You know,
right.
Then we're looking for other people to like validate us. And it's just, it's stress. It's stress.
It's stress. And it's a special kind of stress. I love that you said that it's just different and it's more for us, because I've done a lot of interviews at this point, and I often hear people often ask me, okay, well, what do we think we should do to support our Black medical students? And I'm like, you have to start by acknowledging that it's different and harder for us, right? In ways that are hard, that are not as easily defined and not clearly as objective. The battle is different, right? We come in already having to, like, first of all, as you mentioned, protect our patients, our Black patients, in a different way, right? Like, and we have to put ourselves in the line of fire in order to do that, right? Because people don't like to be told that they're wrong. And there's this entrenched hierarchy in medicine that really keeps you from challenging your attendings or your residents, right? They can destroy your entire career. You know?
One line.
They can destroy your entire career. And they do that sometimes, right? And I think that, you know, sometimes I think occasionally non-Black people will read my book and be confused by the tonal shifts when she's in the hospital versus when she's with her friends and when she's with her family, because they don't realize that she's code switching, right? Like, the whole time I'm like, I have Angie code switches for every situation that she's in. And how she talks with her friends is when she's most comfortable and her most herself, right? And all these other times she's having to be someone who's, she's not quite exactly.
Oh my gosh, honestly. And you know what, to be honest, I don't even think that I necessarily noticed that she was code switching, because it's probably so natural to me. You know what I mean? But you're right, because you see and read when she's like going to the Beyonce concert and this freedom that she's feeling. We all know what it means when you go to a Beyonce concert. And if you don't, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast, disrespectfully. But, you know, she's just like, she's got her fit ready. They're like vibing. She's able to exhale, because at right. home, there's this idea of, you know, I know my mom will listen to this and I love her, but there's this idea and this pressure of, you know, being a good, you know, Ghanaian child, which we see throughout this, throughout the entire story, really. But the performative nature of being an immigrant child, right? That's one right. thing. And then now packaging that into being at work and them feeling and, you know, needing to see you all the time and see you stressed out and like people enjoying that and thriving off of that in a weird way. And then in her friend with her friends, it's like, I'm not a wig person, but I imagine if I took my bra off and this is it. And she's like, I'm cool. I'm free. And actually what I really liked was, not to give any spoilers, but at some point she is now exploring her identity by herself. And you really see how freeing it can be to live in a world without everyone's expectations on you, be it your parents, right. be it your, even your friends, be it your, the people who are seeing you in a work setting or in a medical school setting. There's so much range. There's so much range to these characters that is, I just deeply appreciate. I really do.
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. Now, Ricky, I have feelings about Ricky.
Mm-hmm.
I have feelings.
I know.
So tell me about when you were deciding on the character of Ricky, what were your inspirations? What sort of led you down his character arc, etc.?
Yeah, so Ricky is very controversial. But I really created him after some of my favorite men in my life, right? There are parts of my husband who are in Ricky, one of my best friends. A huge part of their initial meeting is just inspired by this best friend who's engaged to my other best friend, right?
Okay.
But inspired by that, which is, you know, he's a really good guy, a really good man, who just does things that are unintelligible sometimes for us as women, right? And in my first go around with On Rotation, I actually had his perspective, right? So you could see a little bit more about kind of what he's thinking, et cetera, right? And we ended up deciding to take that away because we thought that it took a lot of the tension out, right? Because a lot of the tension for he and Angie's Will They Won't They comes from Angie not knowing what's going on in this man's head, right? And so what I really wanted to create was a character who himself had agency. My husband kept telling me, like, you know, he reads these rom-coms, he hates them because a lot of times the men are perfect and they always pick the woman and all of this time, you know. And he was like, he would be like, Shirley, more agency, right? And so I wanted to give Ricky his own agency, his own backstory, his own motivations, you know, and to put that, those insecurities, motivations, and agency up against Angie's, right? So that even though these two characters, and again, I'll try to avoid having spoilers, like clearly care about each other, that they for a long time kind of are not on the same page, right? And I think it's been really fun to see different people's wildly different takes on this, because I think that a big point of what I was trying to do with Angie was to also have her learn about other people's perspectives and to see people in the whole way that she sees herself and learns to see herself, right? I wanted to do that in part with a love story, right? And so it's been fun because there are people who are hardcore team Ricky, people who are hardcore team Angie, and sometimes I got to step away because I'm like, all right, guys.
Hey, firstly, I'm very happy that you took his perspective out because I do think, I mean, and sort of to compare to like Insecure, some critiques have been that there was a lot more sensitivity regarding like men on the show versus like women. And what I do really love about this story is this is your, like, not your, but Angie's perspective, you know, a Black female Ghanaian doctor, et cetera, so many identities. And I love that you're just trying to, like, you're focused on her story. How is she seeing the world? How is she changing? How is she learning? And you know what? I'm just going to say it. I would have been annoyed, although annoyance sometimes is necessary to develop plot, I get. But I feel like if it would have been like, oh, but actually, I would have now empathized with him too much. And that is the danger that sometimes we as women take on. Like, we overly empathize with people who maybe are going through difficult times, but don't exercise that empathy towards us. And so I like that you left his perspective out. And I mean, ultimately, it comes together very nicely or interestingly. So for the people that haven't yet read it. But you mentioned learning about other people and other people's perspectives. And I think that segues very nicely into Angie. Is it Nia or Nia?
Nia.
Nia. Okay. Nia's relationship with Angie and then Nia's relationship with Shay is such a nice way to explore different identities that Angie doesn't identify as. And I will say at first I was like, is Nia like, is it going to be one of these? She's into Angie and she's, you know, like that weird friend dynamic where sometimes people aren't. So, but I loved that Nia sort of had her own identity that she was now also exploring, which is, again, to bring it back to the third year aspect of medical school, it's so insular and you're so in your world. And I always say, like, med school is the most selfish and selfless time because the world is crazy. People are dying in front of you and you're trying to, like, stay alive academically, future-wise as well. So it's hard to pan out, but people are going through things as well. And I like that Nia was kind of like, well, how much are you checking in on me? And I think that, right, like, that's super relatable. I definitely have had friends that I think felt, maybe they didn't share it, but felt like, you know what, it's not just about you. You know, I have a twin sister who I'm always like, well, I like, work is just crazy. And this person isn't even doing anything. They're just doing that. And my sister's like, you're invalidating their whole life. The world is bigger. And I really loved that we got to see Nia sort of exploring love for the first time and different friend groups while still having this tenderness between Angie and Nia. Like their relationship is so special and so unique. And I loved how that was prioritized throughout the story.
Yeah, I really wanted to give platonic relationships a place to shine, because I think a lot of times romantic ones in these stories take the limelight. For Nia and Angie, I think that in your early 20s, especially, like, your platonic relationships will often be the most important ones that you have, right? And I wanted there to be growing pains in that aspect. And as you kind of mentioned, like Angie's doing this incredibly intense career, right? Like, it's incredibly intense. There's really just no way she's going to be able to take everybody's side, right? Like, to take everybody's side with, or like to understand everybody's perspectives, right? Or not even to be conscientious all the time, right? So I wanted Nia to call her out on that, because I do think that, you know, I wanted my side characters to be their own separate people. And in being their own separate people, that they too would have feelings about, you know, always supporting somebody who's not necessarily giving that support back, right? Oh gosh, I'm giving spoilers, aren't I?
this is medical. Like, anyone who knows medicine, there's a balance, and sometimes it's not balanced. So yeah, I don't think it's a full spoiler.
Right. Thank you. So I wanted to give some credence to that. And I also, I mean, honestly, like, it was important for me to have, you know, a friend who was queer, right? Like, who in a queer relationship, right? With a straight friend. And like, one of the things at some point that Angie like does feel is that, you know, Nia wants to have a community too, right? You know, the same way Angie wants to have, like, has her Black girl community, right? And has her sanity circle. Nia needed that too in a lot of ways. So I Nia's like my favorite character. she is, I absolutely love her, because I think she's molded from some of my favorite people in the world. Mm. And I wanted her to shine just as much in her own way than it, as Angie does.
Yeah, and I think that, like, each of the side characters could have their own, like, this is a multiverse, you know? Like,
right.
There are so many stories that I would love to hear about and, you know, think about, explore how things go in that way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like you said, learning about other communities that are different, it was very nice, because it's just nice that Angie was open-minded and mm-hmm. about learning where her blind spots were and where her faults right. were. And you sort of see that explored in a way that I think is very meaningful.
One foundational skill all junior doctors obtain is the ability to recognize a deteriorating patient. A deteriorating patient is someone who is clinically at a crossroads. They will either need support in intensive care because of multi-organ failure, or for those without the physiological reserve for intense intervention, a decision is made to honor the natural course of life that ends, hopefully as comfortably as possible. Today, I'd like to apply those same principles to the United States. The U.S. government system is formed by three branches: the executive branch, meaning the president, the judicial branch, meaning the Supreme Court, and the Congress. These branches work together to ensure the survival of the nation, much like the many organ systems of the body. Commonly, when a patient begins to deteriorate, they have a history of chronic conditions. They may have increased clinical frailty, or there may be trauma to the body that makes them vulnerable to deterioration. One might argue the hyperpolarization of politics, de-intellectualization, and intentional assault of the political system are comparable and have equally created a very, very vulnerable democracy. In medicine, we aim to manage these conditions as best we can with medication and lifestyle advice, but sometimes those conditions cross a line and are no longer reversible. In America, many of the same accommodations have been made through voting, advocacy, and frighteningly, lobbying. Despite all of these efforts, when a patient enters a period of deterioration, we must decide. Is their body strong enough to endure the hardship of organ support and intensive care? Or do we have to accept that all life comes to an end and focus on supporting all of their deteriorating body's needs, knowing that soon the body will no longer be alive? In my humble opinion, America has reached a similar crossroads. We've seen the warning signs for years. We have managed and accommodated, hoping for the best. But now we have to make a decision. And no matter what we decide, we have to accept that if left alone, America is incapable of sustaining itself in its present state. We will either fight harder than we ever have with intense action, or accept that everything that rises also falls. What do y'all think, shiftmates? Intensive care or end of life? And if you've chosen intensive care, how are you going to support the effort?
Where are we? I mean, are we interning next? Are we fellowshipping next? Where are we going with these characters, or are we going anywhere with them?
Well, it depends on my sales. I it took me a while to let go of the characters, right? Because it's funny. A lot of us authors talk about this, that you spend years sitting in these characters' brains and working and reworking their stories, right? And you, like, eventually you have to let them go, right? And I had a hard time letting them go. So I wrote a lot of a sequel, but the thing is it's traditional publishing, right? And in the women's fiction rom-com genre, especially because in a lot of ways On Rotation is, they took a chance, right? Publishing's already working on publishing non-white, cis, straight voices, you know? And On Rotation sits on a cusp of genres. It ignores a lot of conventions. and I like it that way. I'm so happy I was able to find a team who was also willing to take a chance on it, right? But it needs to sell well for me to be able to sell a sequel.
Gosh, I really am very deeply invested, clearly. And I want to know where this is going. Like, I see this, you know, Normal People had its own story, and there's a lot of feedback that people have given. But in the same way that had a show, I'm just saying, like, is Hollywood calling? Because these characters are very rich. There's so much, like, room for development. I love it. I really do hope that it sells. And I completely understand. There's a reason why me reading this, I'm like, whoa, is this, I'm seeing myself. This is because we exist across so many different identities and target demographics. And so because we are so multifaceted, we're often ignored. Yeah. And in the same way that Angie needed to recognize her blind spot and was open to seeing and learning about something that she didn't know much about, I really hope that readers as a whole also embrace this, you know, because ultimately, like you said, it's a coming age story of a young woman in a very stressful period of her life, understanding the world and how she fits into it and how to sort of manage and navigate the expectations of so many, and then learning to prioritize herself as well. And anyone can identify with any of those things. It's not a medical thing. It's not a Ghanaian thing. It's not a Black girl thing. It's an everybody thing, you know, because none of us.
Absolutely.
So I don't want to take too much more of your time, but I do want to know more about Sherlene and your own journey. How did you decide you wanted to be a doctor? And then further going into cardiology.
Sure. So I have a fairly boring I want to be a doctor story. My mom's a physician. She's a neonatologist. And when we came to the United States, she was a resident. So my childhood was marked by watching her work insanely long hours, because I think it was right around the time the duty hours got instated. So she worked in that free period. And right afterwards, we moved to a really small town in Arkansas, and she was the only pediatrician there for like 50,000 people or something, which meant that it was all hands on deck. So I spent a lot of time in hospitals. I did a lot of fundraising stuff. Yeah, I earned my allowance by putting stickers on Reach Out and Read Books, you know. And so I kind of grew up in this environment. And as I got older, I tried to rebel a little bit or push away from it. But I ended up always going back to it. And I think it's because, you know, for me, I really need a reason to get up and go to work every day, right? And I can do it. I can wake up at 5 a.m. if I know that I'm needed. And I just couldn't find that fulfillment in a lot of other careers, you know, that drive, that thing that would motivate me. And so I think medicine ended up kind of being this thing that I was like, oh, I guess I'm doing it. And it was very funny because if you ask, my parents were terrified I was going to choose something else. They were like, oh gosh, is she going to decide to be an artist or a writer or something like that? Right. They're like, and I had to reassure them. I'm like, look, guys, like, chill. you're not pushing me to do this. So I'm doing it to myself. I feel the same way about cardiology. Cardiology in the United States is, I think, 12.5% women, 12.5% underrepresented minorities. And so that means I'm the first Black woman to come through at my fellowship program in something like 15 years. And I'm in Southside, Chicago. So there are not many of us, as I say the least. But I think for cards, it was a couple things for me. I actually love the zigzaggy EKG things. I love the physiology. I think it's fascinating. It's interesting to learn about. It's always cutting edge, right? It's so evidence-based, and I'm a simple gal. I like when things are simple. I don't want to be talking about nephrons, okay?
That's a proximal convoluted tubule.
I'm like, oh, glomerular, what? Like, no, I'm joking. Like, FSGS? I don't care. Like, anyway, that's not true. I don't really care. I care about the kidneys when they start messing with the heart. Anyway. And then there was also the factor of it that, you know, cardiovascular disease still is the number one killer, right? You know, even after all this time, this investment. And there's a lot of need, I think, for education within the community. And a lot of what I'm doing with my art and with my writing even is to kind of passively educate. And I think that maybe this is me having a little bit of a savior complex. It's like, look, I enjoy it. And I also think I'm needed in it. Right. And I really, at the end of this, I'm going to eventually start writing books that are kind of in the cardiology world. Right. And there aren't that many people doing more narrative medicine style things in this world. It's a very much still a basic science kind of traditional clinical research field. And so I want to be able to, through narratives and through fiction and through art, show people a little bit more about their cardiovascular health, right? And so, yeah, that was a really long drawn out answer to your question. Sorry.
No, that was great. That was great. And now it's making even more sense that you are highly overextended because clearly you grew up seeing someone pouring their everything and every minute. So you're like, oh, this is normal.
Oh, my mama still works like crazy. Oh,
yeah, I think that's so interesting. I interviewed Chidiya Bere, who was the guy who went viral for the image of the pregnant woman who was Black. And how he got into it was also very much so, he'd been doing some public health work and realize all their diagrams were like images of white women in like the villages of Nigeria. They're going to look at that and say, this is a white person's disease, you know? So it's such an interesting space. I mean, I bet if there was a nice story for me to learn about EKGs, I would know what a T-wave inversion was.
I don't know what I can accomplish in that one.
I'm just saying there's room there. I'm giving you some ideas. But yeah, I mean, that's phenomenal. I think you're going to obviously have a wonderful career. You're obviously doing so well already. So you chose cardiology because of, you know, it made sense, you know, all those ventricles and valves and all of that. Where do you see yourself going in terms of all of it? Big question.
Oh, before you're asking me the hard questions. it's going to depend on a lot of, because I think for a while I could kind of predict how things are going to go. I will admit, when I wrote On Rotation, I expected that I would just write a book, have a week of some fanfare, and then be done, right? And things have gone exceptionally well, right? I just got to announce yesterday that I was the Marie Claire book club pick for July. You know, it's in the UK now, as you know, and was the Apple pick for June for in Australia and New Zealand. You know, so there are things that are moving. There's stuff I can't tell you about. It depends on where those things go. My general feeling is that I want to probably practice part-time, right? I'm going to be a general cardiologist. I don't really want to subspecialize. I want to see patients maybe 1 to 2 days a week, right? So really part-time, right? And to spend the rest of the time really with my family, writing, et cetera. Because as you said, I'm overextended as is, and there are a lot of things I want to get done in my life. And I'm someone who wants to live life to its fullest. And so I think that I will have to find balance in those ways eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm grateful that you are showing so many people about, one, what it means to occupy these identities, but also that, most importantly, like, when a doctor is a doctor, they're not just a doctor. They're a human. Right. They have interests. They have passions. And there's not one way that you have to exist in medicine, which I think it adheres to my overall goals in this podcast, amplifying the voices of people that are living out loud and doing it well. The last question that I have for you, in the theme of fictional medicine, I'm obviously in the UK, I'm obviously American. Everyone asks me, is medicine in America like Grey's or whatever? And I'm always like, like more maybe kind of like Scrubs-ish. But even that, there's liberties. And now I've already started telling people, your answer is On Rotation. Read it, because then you'll know. And maybe one day you'll see somewhere. In the spirit of all of that, looking at all of the various fictional television stories, which characters or television shows would you identify with most now in your stage of where you are, and why?
Oh, you mean now as I am? I, Sherlina Bobby, am right now?
Yes. Well, you know what? Let's make it spicy. Let's do one for you and one for Angie.
Okay. For me, it's a little bit harder because I don't know whether I've seen myself reflected in a character that well. I think when I look at actresses, I love Michaela Cole. I think I worship her. I mean, Ghanaian goddess. She's everything. And I also love Bolu, and I've forgotten her last name. She wrote Honey and Spice is coming out. She wrote Love and Color. And so those are people who I kind of look up to who are in the entertainment sphere. As far as Angie, I think Angie, a lot of Issa Rae Insecure references get made, which I think is true to an extent for her. I actually think if you ever watch Awkward Black Girls, like Issa Rae's like first YouTube series. Yeah. I think maybe closer to that. Yes. I think Angie's probably a little closer to that. In the medical shows, I don't know whether there's anyone who quite like lines up, because she's not a Meredith, you know, like
she's not a Meredith, and she's not, I don't even, I'm like,
the not a Christina.
Yeah, she's not a Christina.
Yeah, she's not really quite any of them. She could be a female JD, right? Like a little bit, you know, it's very difficult. And actually, I had the same issue when we were trying to sell On Rotation, because they were like, we need comps. I'm like, what are the comps? My whole team is like, what are the comps? So none of us come up with comps. And so I'm giving you a very much a non-answer, but hopefully the next person who writes something in this similar vein and gets it published can use Angie as a comp.
Yes, I love that. I equally think that she fits, one, in terms of series-wise, I would put her on Scrubs. for sure.
Yeah.
He's not, it's like everything isn't the deepest thing in the world, like Grey's, you know. I mean, yes, some things happen because that's the nature of the career, but she's enjoying herself as well as best as she can, which I think, you know, that's very Scrubs-ish in my opinion.
Right, right.
Anyway, well, thank you so much for chatting with me today. Is there anything else that we haven't spoken about that you would like to say or share? Any advice for people?
You know, it's funny when it comes to the advice side of things. What I always tell people, especially those of us who are in medicine, is that a lot of our careers try to put us into one dimension, right? That you're supposed to be an engineer or a lawyer or a doctor. And medicine is especially pretty guilty of that. And I will be honest, like even getting to this point has required me to very much stand my ground and be myself loudly, proudly, and at times aggressively, right? And that for my medical students who are listening, that might look different for you, right? Because the fact of the matter is that if you want to pursue this as a profession, you still have to do some contorting and you still have to fulfill some of these standards that maybe don't make a lot of sense, or they don't really inform how good of a doctor you will be, but are important for getting into the next stage. And so to find that balance between focusing on that and making sure you don't neglect that aspect and still being true to yourself. Don't try to be me though, right? Because it's hard. It's I got lucky in a lot of ways. I got lucky in a lot of ways. I had really great mentors. I happened to be great clinically. So I was able to kind of balance these things, but it's not, I try to make people realize that it is very difficult and that they shouldn't feel like they're behind or something if they're not able to do it.
And we all, I think one of my friends used to really call me out on this, and I'm sure you've heard it so many times, that it's not luck, it's a skill set, you know? And yes, there are some things that, you know, you're fortunate to be blessed with certain opportunities and things, but it's a skill set that you have mastered, you studied and you've mastered, and as such, you're excelling. So everyone might not be able to get that same skill set, but they can find their own. That's all I would sort of just add a little asterisk.
I like that, Victoria.
Well, thank you so much. And where can people follow you and order the book and Audibles and all of that?
Awesome. The book can be ordered anywhere books are sold. So Barnes & Noble. I love independent booksellers. So try to find an independent bookstore near you. Bookshop.org also, if you're in the United States, is also a place you can get it. It's in Waterstones, et cetera, in the UK. You can follow me at ShirleyWorldMD on Instagram and on Facebook, or at Shirlene Abobi, my name, on Twitter. And my website is shirlenabobi.com. So if you have any thoughts, you can hit my contact box and hit me up.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Shirlene. You can follow her on Instagram at ShirleyWhirlMD, which is ShirleyWhirlMD. And you can find her book on rotation literally everywhere. Your local bookstores, bigger bookstores, online at Amazon, websites like that. Or if you're into audiobooks, you can find it at Audible. I really think you'll enjoy it. If you've enjoyed this season, please like, share, subscribe, and follow us on Instagram, Night Shift Delirium. Our Twitter is kind of on EOL, but we're trying. And in the meantime, the most important thing after a night shift is to ensure that you have a great rest. Wellness sometimes feels like a buzzword in medicine that we apply to everyone else but ourselves. But the only way to ensure that you can take care of others is if you take care of yourself. So I'm going to do what I do after every night shift to make sure that I can take care of myself and others. I'm going to take a rest. I'm going to have a break. And while I take a break and take a rest, I hope that you all do the same. There's a lot going on in this world, and the only way that we're going to be able to make any sort of change is if we take care of ourselves first. That being said, like I mentioned in the interlude, If you're in America, now's the time to be thinking about what path you're going to take. Are we going to let things fall, or are we going to fight for survival? I sincerely hope that you're able to take some time and rest during this break, and we will see you on our next shift.